So the theme is the seven factors of awakening. And perhaps it's easy to hear these teachings and these words and think of them as practices. This is what I'm supposed to do. But the way it's presented in the texts, it's more, these are states that arise. And as we recognize them, we can support them, and we can do the things that nourish them, that feed them and grow them. And so it's not so much that we're supposed to do these things. And so this idea that we're not relying on doing, but rather on a natural process of cultivation, of growing, of allowing to develop, it's kind of a remarkable idea. And it suggests that these things are in us, that there's a naturalness to them, and that if we participate in the natural process that supports them, that they will grow. If you plant a seed in the soil and you care for it properly, water it, fertilize it, protect it, the seed will germinate and the plant will grow. And so we, in a sense, we have these seeds inside of us that can get watered and sprout and grow into these beautiful plants. And there's several texts in this ancient teachings of the Buddha that talks about what nourishes the seven factors of awakening. And I mentioned it yesterday, but only in relationship to sati, to mindfulness, that what nourishes and supports it is careful attention. It turns out that careful attention supports the other six as well. And then the text, the Buddha talks about particular things we give careful attention to for the growth and development of each one. So there's, you know, not just having careful attention, but careful attention to particular things. That it's kind of like the attention we have is food. And that depending on where that food goes, it feeds one thing or another. And we want it to feed things that are supportive and helpful for us. And many times we feed things which are the opposite. We feed things which are undermine our physical, mental, spiritual, emotional health one way or the other. And so the idea of learning where we put this food and be able to redirect it, not to avoid, not to deny that things are there, but to find a way to engage that attention so the attention is nourishing of something good. So even bringing attention to our suffering, it isn't necessarily we're feeding the suffering, but we might be. Depending on how we bring the food of attention to the suffering. If the attention is accompanied by self-pity or accompanied by self-criticism or shame, or is accompanied by conceit, or, you know, conceit in the Buddhist language means that I'm better or that I'm worse than others, or even that I'm equal to others. And the protest is, well, what's left? And what's left is not to compare yourself, which is kind of freeing. Just allow yourself to be who you are, as you are. No need to even establish, in a certain kind of way, that you're equal. And we're all equal in allowing ourselves to be as we are, in some profound way. And so, you know, if we have these unfortunate associations or minglings with attention, then we're feeding the suffering, and the suffering can grow and get worse or whatever it might be. The hindrances grow and develop, and they can get really difficult. If the attention goes in other directions, And if it goes to feed, directly feeds the seven factors of awakening, they grow. But it's not just the attention, but it's also how we pay attention. It isn't just what we pay attention to and seeing and what's there, but it's so important how we pay attention. So the how. This morning I mentioned what, but sometimes we want to ask how. How am I in relationship to what I'm paying attention to? Am I straining or boring down? Someone used a wonderful expression today of being an archaeological dig. You know, I'm going to go in there, just dig down and find out what's really going on. Are we aversive to something? Or do we hate it? Or do we, how do we relate even to beautiful qualities like seven factors of awakening? People can have complicated relationships too. And so the attention we bring to it might not actually feed them, it might actually feed the hindrances. So, concentration is classic for this, that, somehow that concentration is held up, somehow it gets singled out of the seven factors of awakening. Sometimes concentration is like, that's what is supposed to happen, supposed to get concentrated, and then there's ranks of concentration and all kinds of things. And competition. Concentration competition, the people competing against each other, whoever can get the most concentrated, and all kinds of things can happen with. So the attention is going to concentration, but there's desire, greed, craving, competition, trying to get away from things. I think most meditators sooner or later who develop some ability to get concentrated will use it to avoid what's going on. And I did it for quite a while, where I would use it to avoid my physical pain, because I learned that if I got concentrated, the pain would disappear. If I stopped getting concentrated, it would come back. So, of course, what's the solution? To be concentrated all the time. And so I would kind of get into my zone and no pain, great. That's good. But it wasn't healthy for me. It wasn't like I wasn't supporting a healthy states of mind or attitudes. I was supporting avoidance. And so at some point, which should come as no surprise to you, at some point it stopped working. And then you know what I was left with? With my pain. And then I had to come to a whole different relationship to it, but it was a little bit rocky because I'd kind of gotten attached and proud of my ability to avoid it and get concentrated and all kinds of, strange things, right? And so when I could no longer do it, I was frustrated and upset, and then I had to just be with pain, and then I had to learn a new way to be with pain. And that was really when the practice opened up in an important way, to learn how to be with pain in a way that was not aversive, not in conflict, in a way that could open to it, make space for it, attend to it with careful attention. So each of the seven factors of awakening are supported by careful attention. Now the word that the Pali word that Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as careful attention is a very interesting word that maybe no one really knows what it means exactly. But it's so evocative that you can't help but to want to explain it nicely. So it's yoniso manisikara. Something like that. And so the kara means to do or to make. The maniso is the mind or mental activity. And so that becomes usually attention. So you make a certain kind of attention, certain kind of mind state, certain kind of mentality. And then yoniso It comes from the word yoni, one of the meanings which is a womb. A womb. The womb's where baby grows. And so it's and it's from the womb is the grammar apparently. So it's the attention or the doings of the mind or mentality that arises out of something deep inside that's somehow equivalent of to a womb. And some people refer to it as wisdom, that which is primary or deep inside of us. So some people translate it as wise attention instead of careful attention. But this idea that it's connected to this word for womb, that's where it's so evocative. What does that mean? And why is that, what is that a choice? And I like it because it suggests this natural process of growth and something that arises out of the nature of our being. It's not something foreign to us. And we're allowing something to grow, develop, emerge from the depth inside of us, a natural capacity. So for whatever reason, Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as careful attention. I just love it. The idea that we were going to be caring, careful, we would care for what we bring our attention to, we're careful of what we bring our attention to. It's kind of like, it relates to the idea of compassion and kindness and seeing it as important. And maybe what's most important is not necessarily what we bring our careful attention to, but rather what's most important is we bring a careful attention. We can often focus on the object of attention as being important. Maybe what's important is just the fact that we go around with careful attention, compassionate attention, kind attention to whatever it is. Now, I'm sure that that careful and kind, careful attention is useful for no matter what you look at. I think it moves things towards health, moves things through the right direction. But this careful attention that is not trying to change things, but as we pay attention, what we pay attention to maybe feels safe with us or feels the kindness or feels the lack of conflict. We don't meet it with our conflict and our anger or shame or guilt or just careful attention to whatever's there. Maybe we do have shame. Maybe we do have guilt. Maybe we do have fear and suffering. And the task is how do we hold that in kind, careful attention? How do we meet that? And as some of you know, I love the image as an image for mindfulness. The image I'm doing now is having two hands come together, cupping them, so making a little cup or something, and then like holding something tenderly, carefully with an open hand, receiving something. So to have the mindfulness, this careful attention, almost like it comes underneath our suffering and our challenges and just holds it there. It just allows it to be what it is, but it feels supported and held. I think it's a powerful thing. And so, anyway, the Buddha says that how these seven factors of awakening are supported is through this yoniso manasikara, this natural capacity we have for wise attention, careful attention. Now, in terms of the second factor of awakening, which we usually translate as investigation, he's a little bit more specific about what we pay attention to, what we hold with this careful attention. And what we hold in attention is our ability to see the distinction between ouch and ah. And this ouch and ah, it's kind of silly and maybe childish to, here I am an old man and, I'm supposed to be more sophisticated. I have a PhD in Buddhism and I just like some teaching about ouch and ah. But and there's not even a Pali word for it, probably. And but what I like about it is that it's Alchana comes out of direct experience. There's no of, you know, it's something we feel and experience. Ouch, or ah, that's good. And so that's why I like the word so much. It's like so immediate and direct, and it's in touch with something we can know. And you kind of usually, I mean, I guess you can have intellectual ouch, you know, like you some big puzzle you're trying to intellectually solve, and you realize you just went down the wrong way, and it took you 2 years to realize it, and ouch. So maybe that's kind of ouch too. Maybe that's direct enough, but you know, this normally it's really a direct, almost sensory thing to ouch and ah. So that kind of immediacy of the experience is being suggested by it. So to make that distinction, and so the Buddha does it, of course, in a more sophisticated way, and we'll get to that. But this very simple distinction, and over again, he tends to make this binary distinction that fits into the category that Gill says of ouch and ah. The most common way the Buddha refers to this is the distinction between what is wholesome and unwholesome. Or some people prefer the translation, what is skillful and unskillful. So he's into this this binary, dichotomous ways of thinking. And his point of view of, there's, as I said yesterday, there's a fork in the road, and you have to, and you, it makes a difference which of those forks you take. And so, you know, you want to take the fork that's skillful. You want to take the fork where it's wholesome, that goes towards the ah, or goes towards healthy. Healthy and unhealthy. And so what we bring careful attention to support the growth of the thing that we translate into as investigation, is careful attention to what's wholesome and unwholesome, to see what's skillful and not skillful. And then this thing that we call investigation arises. But the English word investigation, I think it's so easy for us to interpret this as we have to do this thing. You know, an investigation doesn't just happen. You know, you sit there and you're looking around, and, you know, investigation is more like an active thing that we do. So it's probably not the right translation for dhammavicaya, this word that the Buddha refers to. And the more literal meaning of the word, or this compound word dhammavicaya, dhamma here means states of mind, qualities of mind. And vicaya means, apparently it means to discriminate, to differentiate. The differentiation of states. As we get quieter and stiller, and as the mind is not swirling and busy and not really sensing and feeling and seeing what's going on, what arises almost naturally is things start standing out in highlight. And as things stand out in highlight, we see the distinction between hating our knee pain and clamping down and getting constricted around it versus offering kind, loving kindness towards our pain or to ourself, or to meet the pain with simple open mindfulness and awareness. And that becomes really obvious after a while. Not right away, but with time you start seeing there's a distinction. There's two different ways I can be with this pain. I can be present for it in a careful way, open way, without any aversion. Or I can be present for it with lots of aversion. Which of those is skillful? Which of those is wholesome? This is not an analysis that we have to do, but as the mind gets quieter and stiller, and the mindfulness gets sharper, the awareness is stronger, it becomes patently obvious. Why would I It's kind of like, you're thinking about, you come to a retreat and all you can think about for the first day is revenge. And, then you feel justified and you feel like it's the right cause and this person deserves it. And so you're swirling in thoughts and plans of revenge. And by this, maybe by the second day or the 50th day of the retreat, at some point you're quiet enough and still enough and somehow maybe even the thoughts and ideas of revenge have receded for a while, and it's kind of a relief. And then something happens that reminds you of the person, and you can start feeling that those thoughts come back. But because you're so settled and the intention is strong, you see it begin to arise, and you feel, this is ouch. This is not skillful. This is not going in a good direction. If I pick this up and get involved, I spend like 50 days, 50 hours, however long, finally it's settled down and I'm not in its grip anymore. And here it's coming again. Ouch. And a person who sees this might have enough presence and ability to say, okay, I'm not going to pick that up. I'm not going to get involved with that. But it isn't so much analytical or thought out. That distinction, seeing that this is unhealthy, unskillful, unwholesome, becomes clear. So one of the functions of mindfulness is to help us start being sensitive to what's wholesome and unwholesome, the ouch and the ah. And that's a hugely important part of what in Buddhism is called wisdom. So it's not anything more sophisticated than that, than being able to really see this is healthy and this is unhealthy. And as I want to reinforce, it's not a matter of analysis. It's not a matter of thinking it out. But there's something about in the immediacy of experience, where the mindfulness is really here, we get that message. The message just comes. And so to call it an investigation maybe sounds like we have to do a lot of work. But in these seven factors of awakening, it's more like if we bring careful attention to our ability to sense and feel the ah and the ouch, feel the wholesome, the unwholesome, feel the qualities of what's going on, what we can do, it starts becoming obvious what direction to go, which path to take. And having this ability to make these distinctions is one of the important ways that we become our own teacher. And that's one of the goals of doing this practice, is to be able to find the path for yourself rather than relying on, other external teachers and books and all that. To be able to read the Dharma book for yourself, you read it in your own heart, in your own being, by being able to make this simple distinction. This is healthy, this is not healthy. When I came back from spending 3 years at the Zen monastery, the Zen monastery was such a choreographed place. How you stand, how you sit, how you eat, how you bow, how you, just about everything. You have to do it a certain way. So when I left, I suddenly didn't have to do it all this way. And the remarkable thing I realized was that in all these little small details of my life, I had a choice. And I was making a choice how I would sit in a chair. When I was younger, I never conceived that sitting in a chair was something that involved any kind of choice, conscious choice. You just sit, right? And I was so not aware of what I was doing or anything. But coming back from that monastery, 2, 3 years of training, I realized, like, wow, I'm just not an innocent thing to sit down in a chair. I'm making a choice. Subconsciously, or something's making a choice. And is that the choice that I want to live? And I said, no, that's not, if I really paid attention, some of those choices on how to sit in the chair had maybe some very, very mild kind of innocent, maybe kind of ouch. And other than had a very clear, this is healthy, this is skillful, this is useful. And sometimes it was just very subtle shift and change. So I started seeing all these choices I had and all these little movements. And it wasn't like I decided to do this. It came out of that monastic training and a lot of practice and sitting, this heightened sensitivity. And that was being my own teacher in all these different ways that, you know, little differences in how we behave and how we speak and what we do, or big differences over time, move us in a direction on the path of practice. And what's nice about this teaching, I believe, is that it's an alternative to a certain kind of magical thinking that can exist in meditation circles, that somehow, in some unknown way, if I just meditate enough, boom, everything will be okay ever after. And it just, you know, you're not quite sure, we're not quite sure what that is, but it must be some it. And, you know, if I just, you know, I'll just, you know, do it, do it, do it. And, you know, there's a teeny bit of truth to that idea that meditation leads to experiences that are quite meaningful and transformative. But the magical thinking can keep people away from making the path for themselves each step along the way. Each time you sit down, each time you pick up a bite of food to eat, each time you serve yourself food, the way you stand in line, what you do with your mind when you're standing in line to have food. You know, it's standing in line at the supermarket. You know, are you going to spend your time perusing the National Enquirer? Is that an ouch or an ah? No, I don't want to find the answer for you. I'm hoping for a certain one. And, you know, so we have all these, you know, so that's how we make the path. And then I had to repeat myself numerous times now. What we're looking for with a factor of awakening is not a doing. So it's not like, in, you know, telling you have to now get serious and do this investigation for yourself. But rather, we're cultivating this careful attention, this caring attention, an ability to stay in the present moment. We start with the mindfulness. And as the mindfulness gets stronger, what follows in the wake of that is this increased sensitivity. And as that increased sensitivity is present, the careful attention to that sensitivity is what nourishes and grows the factor of awakening that most commonly in English is called investigation, discrimination of states. Now, discrimination of states has a lot to do with the how we are. So the way I was taught investigation when I was in Burma was a wonderful way, but was not the way that the Buddha talked about it. It had more to do with focusing on the object of attention and really getting close and boring down and seeing it. Literally, one of the examples of it was taking a fork to spear your broccoli. The teacher said, if you push too hard, I guess in Burma they cooked the broccoli too much, so if you cook it too hard, it falls apart. But if you just kind of don't push enough, it doesn't go in. So you have to kind of penetrate, investigate, really go in and, you know, make the more than just contact, but kind of penetrate the experience. So this is the idea of looking and seeing and seeing. But what happens with that kind of focus, and that happened to many of the people I practiced with my teacher in Burma, they got really, they strained. They tried to look really hard and tight and focused, you know, in some kind of, and they got headaches, they got to wrap themselves up. They got tense and they meditate. There wasn't the relaxation that's needed. And what they weren't taught was also be mindful of the how you're paying attention, how you're attending to your breathing, to your pain, to your emotions, to your thoughts, to your mind. How? And the how is actually quite important. And that's also where we can see this discrimination of states. So what's the attitude we have towards what we're paying attention to? What's the relationship we have towards what we're paying attention to? Are we critical of it? Are we holding on to it? Are we for it? Are we against it? Are we pushing for it? Is there greed in it? Is there aversion in it? Is there generosity in our state? Is there wisdom? Is there kindness? Is there love? How are we as we pay attention? What's the quality of attention, the attitude in which the attention comes through? And so this is a really key part of this discrimination of states, to have the sensitivity to notice the how. So I'd like to give a physical image for you, using my hands, of two different ways of focusing. I usually use this example for concentration, but it could also be for mindfulness. The tip of my finger here is the thing you're going to focus on with your mindfulness or your concentration. And if people hear this kind of like investigate carefully, you know, penetrate with your broccoli, really get into it. Then if my right hand is the mind, awareness. And awareness is made up of many different faculties, many different kinds of forms of attention come together to make up awareness. And so then I go like this. I bring all the different parts of awareness and get really tight, really constricted, really narrow, and I start going, really, you know, it's like my spaceship comes and crashes. So that's, and it's possible to get concentrated, it's possible to have a certain kind of mindfulness this way, but in the long term, it's counterproductive. It can be rewarding even at times, the beginning, but it's kind of, what's much more useful is to have the mind, the awareness, be relaxed and open. Remember the how we're going to be aware. And so if you start feeling the mind getting tight or constricted, relax, open up. It might be dissatisfying because you lose some of the concentration, but that allows you to begin working on meeting the experience, experimenting with how to meet the experience with this relaxed, open awareness. And what's nice about this example of the hands is that, it's not so much that you have to go to the thing, but maybe you come together, or maybe it comes to you. And it comes, but because the hand is open, it touches the soft, sensitive palm right in the middle. This, and because it's so sensitive there, at least my palm is sensitive there, is a very different sensitivity than the fingertips. The fingertips, I could be sensitive, but it's not like pleasant or nice or nourishing. There's something about touching the middle of the palm, and if I kind of rub a little bit, it's so nice. It feels so comfy and nice and soft and kind and warm. And I just, I could just keep doing it. And so it allows you to touch the sensitive part of the mind to do this. The part of the mind that is nourished, supported, and is sensitive, can really see what's going on. To go like this and tighten up and you can't really see or feel the whole field of what's going on. So the how we are. And I learned to do this first with walking meditation. I learned to, when I started to do walking meditation, I was like really serious. And that's where I really learned about the control tower, like up there in the top. It's so far away to my feet, and I'd be up here. You know, sometimes I'd even looking down, you know, I'm going to look at those feet and really, you know, and I learned that, you know, I was so tight and contracted and pushing and wanting something to happen. And so I learned in walking meditation to open my mind, my consciousness really wide and spread it out all in all directions, kind of as if this, it worked for me, this image. I don't know if it worked for you. That I was a passenger seat in the car, and I was just passive, and the world was coming to me. Everything was coming towards me. I was just receiving everything. Even though I was doing the walking forward, in my imagination, for a minute or so, I'd imagine everything just coming to me, and I'm just innocent and not doing anything, just receiving. So this idea of relaxing my awareness quite broad and feeling everything just coming into it, then with that, I would keep the mind that way and drop it down, in a sense, or bring it together with the feet and legs as they walked. And then every once in a while I had to check and see how I was doing, because I would begin tightening up again. And I learned to do that in sitting meditation too, that sometimes I would get, you know, a little bit settled or concentrated, and I'd pull myself out of my state in order to check, how am I doing? Am I tight? Am I constricted? Am I forcing? Am I expecting? Am I wanting? Am I complacent? Am I there, present, but not really there? How am I? And then I'd reestablish a relaxed, sensitive, open awareness, and then I would go back and make contact. And I found that it was much more sensitive, much more alive, much more valuable that way. So to have some care, part of this, you know, discrimination of states, differentiation of states, is to be able to be sensitive to how we're attentive, how the relationship we have to what's going on. And in the context of Dharma practice, like on retreat, which is a very special, unique, unusual situation, very different from the world, which needs us to respond and deal with things in different ways. With here, the hope is a here. It's a generally a really good place to really come back and fall back in the how, a really good, nourishing how, supportive how, and how I'm here. Because so little needs to be just done here. So little needs to be judged or figured out or done or all kinds of things. And that here, we can appreciate that the how we are is maybe the most important thing. The quality of our attention, the quality of our inner life, the quality of how we are in some deep way is the most important treasure we have. And the only person who's the caretaker for the quality of our inner life, quality of our attention, is ourselves. So how do you want to be the caretaker for it? How can you start bringing careful attention to that? And then whatever it is, whatever difficulties you have, any difficulties, can you meet that with a kind of careful attention that is not in conflict with it, that doesn't see it as a problem, but if anything, sees it as something to love, to care for, to hold in the open hand and just be with it. So investigation, what? And if you like, maybe how? For the Buddha then, mindfulness, as it grows, gives rise to this differentiation of states. The differentiation of states gives rise to energy, to effort. And so once again, when you hear the word energy or effort, especially effort, okay, I got to get serious now. You know, let's really apply myself and do something. And there's some truth that we have to, you know, you have to do some effort. But as a factor of awakening, it's learning to recognize something that's maybe more natural, an engagement, an involvement, a with the experience, with the practice, that is not burdensome. It's not like I have to be the one who now make more work, but it's learning to recognize almost a natural enthusiasm, a natural inspiration, or natural movement towards doing the practice because it feels so good. It's wholesome, it's skillful, it's supportive, it's what the system wants to do. And this is one of the great things that I discovered, I felt at some point, was the degree, and it confused me later on, was that at some point, the practice started to practice me. At some point, my job was mostly to get out of the way, to let go of my judgments, attachments, my striving, and just allow the momentum of practice to unfold. And this almost like a natural inner desire to practice, to engage, was there, that I didn't identify it with effort. So much so that I, for a long time, didn't really like the Buddhist teachings on effort. And if, you know, someone taught about it, I just tuned them out. And it got so bad, my relationship with this effort factor, that, you know, I couldn't understand it, and I thought it was just like a mistake that people had to make a lot of effort. Somehow it just meant like they were greedy or a lot of self involved or something. The first time as a teacher, I gave a series of 8 talks on the Eightfold Path. I didn't say anything to anyone, but I just conveniently skipped the right effort. No one ever questioned it. And so it took me a while to realize that I actually put a lot of effort into my practice. Lots of effort. And it was actually part of my strength, the effort and persistence. But when I really got into it, I didn't think it was like something I did. It was just like what happens, or, you know, it's somehow. So to be able to tap into a kind of way of applying ourselves or engaging with practice that is not willful effort. It's not like or effort of I'm going to make the effort. So for some of you, I can well imagine I'm talking like Greek now. You know, what does that mean? You know, what is skills? You know, how can it be effort without will? How can it be effort without me doing the effort? But I think there's probably all kinds of things that you do if you start paying attention that you do effortlessly almost. It just kind of happens. In Zen, they have this wonderful example of in the middle of the night, you're kind of more or less half asleep or something, and without any self-consciousness whatsoever, any preconceived planning or anything at all, your hand goes up and adjusts the pillow so your head is a little more comfortable. Was that, will? It was no willful effort? Was that, you know, is that, you know, like a drag? Oh no, I got to move my pillow. I mean, like, oh my God, you know, this is a disaster. You know, and will I do it right? And what's the right way? And I have to figure it out, you know, how can I, you know, I'll do it the wrong way and someone will notice. And then, you know, just like, oh. So how often in throughout the day do we do things in a very simple, natural way, just like we do it? So it can, as the practice deepens and deepens, there's this new sensitivity that arises, this new openness, this new freedom that begins happening because of the discrimination of states, because we start seeing the ah and the ouch. The system itself is interested in this, wants to do this. It's healthy. It's like, of course. Maybe it's a little bit like, you know, you go for a long hike and after a while you get into the rhythm of hiking and it just becomes, you know, you don't think about it. It's not effort anymore. It's just kind of you're doing it. So what gives rise to what nourishes the effort factor of awakening? The Buddha said, careful attention, caring attention. But he said it's careful attention to 3 things. It's careful attention to the initial beginning of effort, the arousing of effort to begin with. So if you want to be mindful as you're eating, you sit down. It has to occur to you, yes, I should be, I'm going to be really attentive to be present for my eating. And so there is some kind of movement of effort to now gather yourself around the process of eating and no longer look out the window and imagine landscape projects at home or something. But you know, okay, so the initial, there's a beginning. So the Buddha said, if you can have careful attention to that, how you begin what you're going to, act of practice, act of attention, like to mindful eating. So careful attention there. So I interpret that to mean you're careful about the how you start it. So the how is nourishing, supportive. And then careful attention to persisting, to hanging in there. Keep doing it. And careful attention to these words in Pali, we don't know how to translate them, but it has the prefix para, which means higher or beyond or complete. And so I like to think of it as either complete effort or effort beyond effort or effortless effort to not only persist, but somehow enter into what we're doing. Surrender to the doing, what we're doing, so that it's, you know, it's almost effortless to do it, or it's almost like it's fully there. It's entering the full involvement with this. And I learned a little bit about this in my Zen training, especially in Japan. It was great because it was one of my jobs sometimes was to bring the food for supper out to the table, and I was I had to bring the rice sometimes. And so I'd pick up the pot of rice in one hand and carry it one hand, you know, and put it on the table. Boy, did I get reprimanded. It turns out that rice is like, it's almost like the American flag in America. You're supposed to be, hold it carefully and treat it respectfully, otherwise it's... And so white rice is kind of like that in Japan. So you're supposed to hold the pot with two hands. And so a lot of Zen training was about how to hold things with, not just rice, but with two hands. Like you pick up a cup in a Zen monastery, you're not really supposed to pick it up, and you're supposed to really be there with both hands. And really, so the effort is para, to fully, full, all of you, with just you and the drinking. Just that. The very first, very important kind of, you know, if we could use it lightly, but it's a sudden kind of awakening experience I had in my Buddhist practice that came unbidden, because that's how they usually kind of happen, was sitting in a meditation hall like this with a wooden thing in front of me and being served tea and picking up the tea with two hands, bringing it up, just me and the cup and the tea. And when the tea touched my lips, everything stopped. And that was a remarkable moment for me. So this idea of the, you know, there's initial beginning of effort, of bringing attention to something. There's the persistence of it. Hang in there. Keep doing it. Be there. Continuity of practice. And then there's having the effort which is full. Like all of us is in it, as part of it. And some things lend itself to really do that, you know, like, you know, if you're really there with picking up a cup of tea in two hands. Or, you know, what is it like to open a door, like back to doors, right? What is it like to open a door? Kind of like, you know, like opening a door is like incidental. I mean, that's not important. That's just the door is just to open so you can get through it. And but to open, what is the door to door open the door with full attention, full effort, just you and the door. Maybe your mind will stop. If you're really there, just a door. That's so this idea of that your effort is full. So initial application, the persistence of effort, keep it going. And then can you experiment? Can you find what does it mean to really be there in what you're doing, the full attention to what you're doing? Full, you know, the effort is full somehow. So the effort is very, it's a whole, the effort is like a profound topic. But become sensitive to the how we're making effort is also how we do the discrimination of states. You know, that was half-hearted effort. That was whole-hearted effort. That was reluctant effort. That was, you know, I look back over the last sitting and it was okay, but you know, really, I could have, if I'm honest, I could have pretty easily have just been a little bit more attentive and present, you know, and I didn't have to be reviewing all the names in my telephone book, counting them up. You know, I don't, that wasn't really necessary, and you know, I think I could have applied myself more, you know, been really there more. Wholeheartedly there. So there's all kinds of the how we're making effort is important. And then I'll end with this thing about effort, is that one of the real keys to retreat practice is called the continuity of effort, the continuity of practice. And the amount of effort we're supposed to make is whatever effort that's available. The best effort that's available. And when you're tired, it doesn't look very hot. When you're well rested, maybe it looks, you know, some, you know, really good. But it's not supposed to look, you know, it doesn't matter if it looks, you know, not so hot or looks really good. All that matters is that you offer the practice the best effort that's available for you at any given time. And it's the continuity of that kind of the best effort that's available that bears fruit over time. You know, so if you go and during the walking meditation and decide to go have tea, and tea is basically a break, and you check out from, you know, you check out, I'm not being mindful now, you know, because the bell rang at the end of the sitting, and there's no need to be mindful anymore now until, and then I've got to get tea, and I go to get tea, and you finish getting your tea, and then you decide to, and then I'll do walking, and so then you check in again. Okay, it's time to be mindful. And then after 3, 4 minutes of, you know, the walking meditation, you check out because you have to go pee. And, you know, certainly, you know, bathrooms are not the place to be mindful, and so, you know, you're going to taking a break from your practice, and then when you come back out, you come out, and so then you find your walking spot, and you start walking again, and then you realize, you know, I really need to a break. I haven't had a real break yet. So go sit down in a nice chair and close your eyes and just kind of snooze. And after 5, 10 minutes, that was good. Now I should start again to check in to do the mindfulness again. You start again. That's not continuity. That's discontinuity. The idea is if you can stay in the flow of awareness, of careful attention, keep pushing this. Keep kicking the scooter into awareness. Keep opening up into awareness as you stand up from in the hall here. And then how you walk out of this meditation hall is as much of a time of careful attention as when you were sitting. You kind of stay really close to your practice, to your practice bubble. Unless there's a lot of people behind you, how you walk down the stairs. Can you walk down the stairs so that's not a break from practice, that's continues to be the practice. How you stand in line, how you put on your clothes, how you use a toilet, how you use a shower. In fact, all day long, in a relaxed way, remember, a relaxed way, the how you are, keep the mind relaxed, keep coming back to that. But then with that relaxed mind, stay in the flow of attention, stay close, keep coming back. Careful attention to starting over again, each time you need to. Careful attention on hanging in there. And careful attention at the right time, careful attention to how can I be more fully here with this experience. So just really here. And then, the Buddha said, if you have this, the mindfulness growing, that's a factor of awakening, the differentiation of states going, the sensitivity growing, and the effort, the flowing and relaxed, continuous effort going. And then, he says, the Buddha claimed, then there can be the arising of joy. But you might want to wait to do that until tomorrow. Because that'll be the talk for tomorrow. So, but do even so, you know, enjoy yourself. And so thank you. So with that kind of talk and ending, perhaps we can take a minute or so to just kind of reestablish yourself in your practice.